Hey everybody, welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. We had last week off because I was moving, and I'm so refreshed and ready to hear all about animals today. So thanks for joining us. Today we're joined by Arik Hartman, who I had the pleasure of meeting when I was doing a cross-country tour talking all about science communication and squid last fall. And I was just delighted by how much Arik you knew about every animal that we stumbled upon down in Florida. So let's see, any housekeeping that we have today? Not really. We've got 4 sessions total in July. You can check out our schedule on skypeascientist.com and then click the live streams tab from there. The next session that will be happening will be next week. That's going to be lasers and milkshakes. So the scientist that we're going to be talking with studies memory. And to be honest, I don't know how lasers and milkshakes play into this, but he'll explain it next week. I'll be there for that. And then the following week, the 22nd, we're going to be talking about microbes. And then the week after that, the 28th, we're going to be talking about dung beetles. This Thursday, for the adults that are paying attention right now, we are joined by Allie Ward for science trivia. That's on Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. Next week, it'll be Vanessa Hill. She does Braincraft, which is a YouTube channel, but has also been involved with PBS. She's been on PBS, her whole show has. And then the week after that, we've got Jess Phoenix, who ran for the Senate in Arizona 2 years ago. And she's an awesome volcanologist. So she studies volcanoes. And then we're working on the schedule past that. That's really all the housekeeping I have. So let's get into it. Let's talk about animals. So Arik, do you want to tell us who you are, what you do, and why you like it?
Hi, I'm a graduate student at the University of Florida, and I study amphibians and their diseases, so amphibian disease ecology. I study because I've always loved amphibians, and when I found out in my undergrad that amphibians were on a steep decline and racing towards extinction, I was like, no. So I've devoted my academic studies and hopefully the rest of my life to trying to reverse that. So I've started.
Awesome. Okay, so this fungus is called chytrid, is that correct?
Yes, I have a slideshow, just a quick slideshow, if you want me to share it.
Let me give you access to that. Okay, you can share screen.
Share it.
And if you need Erin's interpretation, on the top right, you're gonna see an option for speaker view. Click that. And then there's like 2 rectangles on top of each other. Click that one, and then you'll always be able to see Erin while Arik is screen sharing.
Let's see, can I share? Yes, amazing. Okay, let's get into it. From the top. Oh, let's go back. Okay, so just to give you like the broad taste of amphibian biodiversity, there are 3 orders of amphibians. 2 of them we're probably really familiar with. So there's caudata, which are the salamanders, and there's around 750 species of salamanders. So these are lizard-like amphibians, which are really diverse here in the United States and in North America in general. And then we have Anura, which are frogs and toads, and they make up the bulk of amphibian biodiversity. There's over 7,000 species of frogs. And just a reminder to anyone who's pedantic, toads are frogs. Toads are just a really cool subset of frogs that have a shared evolutionary history. So the next time somebody corrects you, all like, well, that's actually a toad, tell them all toads are frogs. And then the third group are Gymnophiona, which are Sicilians. So these are these elongate, limbless amphibians that we don't know too much about. So they're typically fossorial. They'll live underground in muck or leaf litter. They have reduced vision. So oftentimes their vision isn't that great, but they have these sensory tentacles that push out of their face and they kind of feel around for invertebrate or small vertebrate prey like that. And they're a really interesting group. And there was just a recent paper that came out, I think last week, about they might possibly be venomous. So that's a new thing that we're exploring. I don't study Sicilians. I wish I did, but 2 people in my lab, one is describing a new species of Sicilian from Southeast Asia. And then the other, our postdoc, did her PhD work on Sicilians in South America. So I get to like live vicariously through their Sicilian love.
That's awesome.
So when we think about amphibians.
Do Sicilians live in North America?
No, so they're distributed mostly around the tropics. So I think their northernmost distribution is going to be around Mexico and Guatemala. But you can find them, there's Sicilians in Africa, Sicilians in Asia. So they have that kind of global tropical distribution, but they don't get into North America. Okay. So when we think of amphibian life cycles, we typically think of, oh, a little tadpole, it'll metamorphose into a little froglet, and then we have a frog. But that's just a drop in the pond of the diverse types of life history strategies that amphibians actually have. So some amphibians don't have a tadpole phase at all. Down here is a Coqui frog. So Coquis are found in the Caribbean, and they're direct developing frogs. So the parents will guard the clutch until they hatch, and they'll hatch as these little miniature froglet, like they just look like copies of the parents. Marsupial frogs in the genus Gastrotheca will carry their eggs in a pouch on their back until they develop, and then they'll pop out as little froglets. Slimy salamanders will guard their clutch of eggs from predators, even humans. I've seen them stand their ground against me. And these also directly develop. They don't have an aquatic larval stage like a lot of other salamanders. Some poison dart frog species will carry their tadpoles meters and meters into the canopy to deposit them into bromeliads or little pools of water. Some species will actually come back and lay infertile eggs to feed those tadpoles, and those are called egg feeding poison dart frogs. They're really cool. I keep a species, it's just phenomenal. So the level of parental care in amphibians is a lot greater than most people think. And I think none so more, more so than in Sicilians. So Sicilians have some weird parental strategies. So this species of Sicilian here actually feeds its offspring its skin. So it'll create this kind of fatty layer of skin. And then when these baby Sicilians are born, they'll use their teeth and scrape off that nutrient-rich skin. And there are some Sicilians which produce a type of like uterine milk is what they call it inside of them. And the developing babies will feed on that while they're still inside the mother. So there's really, you know, intricate parental and developmental strategies in amphibians. And it's not just your little squiggly tadpole into an adult. And they also have a bunch of other adaptations that make them so cool. We all know that poison dart frogs are brightly colored. They're aposematic, so they tell everyone that they're poisonous with these brilliant colors, and they're not afraid of anyone. They're very bold frogs. You have Boletta glossa salamanders, which are lungless salamanders that have managed to become arboreal in the tropics. So these amphibians breathe entirely through their skin, but they're able to live high in the canopy in cloud forest because the humidity is constant. And they have these cute little stamp-like feet so that they can stay adhered to leaves. And I just love looking at their feet. We have some amphibians that also, in addition to calling, might wave their limbs. We call this flagging. So this is an Indian frog that does this, but also some frogs in the genus Atelopus, harlequin toads, also limb flag at potential mates and predators. We know that toads have this kind of thickened rough skin because they tend to live outside of water. So this helps them protect them from desiccation. And they also have more of these granular poison glands, so they have more toxic defense than a lot of other frogs. And then some species of salamanders have retained these larval characteristics like these external branchiated gills so they can remain in water their entire lives. So amphibians are really diverse, and I'm not going to throw too much shade on your little pond dwelling frogs because those are phenomenal too, but it's just, there's so much to go off of. So that's why it's really depressing to learn that amphibians are the most threatened vertebrate taxa just in sheer numbers. So like other groups of organisms, amphibians are threatened with human activity, so largely habitat loss and degradation. But amphibians have to also contend with these emerging pathogens. So just like COVID has emerged and wrought havoc on humans, amphibians have been dealing with their own kind of COVID crisis for the past like 30 plus years. And it comes in the form of these two fungal parasites. So the ones that we study are Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis. I know it's a mouthful. We always shorten it to BD. And that's affected mostly frogs and toads, but it can infect all orders of amphibians. And then there's the newly emerged salamander chytrid, Batrachochytrium salamandrophorans, or we call it B-sal. That's very hypervirulent to salamanders. So these are unique. Out of the thousands of chytrid fungi, these are the only two that parasitize vertebrates, and they both parasitize amphibians. So what they do is they colonize the keratinized tissues of amphibians and cause this disease called chytridiomycosis. So keratin is a structural protein found in tissue of amphibians, but it's also found in our tissue, right? It creates our hair, our nails, and it also makes up a good portion of amphibian skin. And this disease, chytridiomycosis, causes those keratinized layers to thicken and it disrupts skin function. So what happens to amphibians when their skin is impaired is they can't osmoregulate as efficiently, so they can't exchange salts with the environment. And that's huge, right? So osmoregulation is important in maintaining physiological function, so your function of your organs and your muscles. It also impedes water transfer. Amphibian skin is typically very thin so that amphibians can exchange water with their environment. And it impedes gas exchange. Many amphibians breathe through their skin. And for some lungless amphibians, it's the only way they can respirate. So typically, animals die from cardiac arrest when they can't get those necessary ions to keep their muscles and their heart from pumping. Oftentimes, amphibians will try to slough off that thickened layer of skin to get rid of that embedded pathogen, and that'll leave them with these open patches of exposed musculature, which can open them up to secondary bacterial infections. So BD has caused massive declines and in some cases extinctions in amphibians around the globe, namely in Central America, in Australia, and the Western United States. And it's been called the worst wildlife pathogen ever, the worst disease ever. It has a huge host range. It's been implicated in the extinction of many species. Whereas B-sal is more recent, and it started decimating salamander populations in Europe, namely fire salamanders. And it's reduced some populations up to 99% in some areas. And B-sal is a little bit different than BD. It forms these ulcerative lesions on salamander skin, so they're a lot more concentrated, but it's thought that they still disrupt the functions of the skin in a similar way. B-sal also has this kind of encysted form of a zoospore that lets it exist in the environment a lot longer than BD spores so that it can resist desiccation and can infect salamanders even long after the salamander has died. Like if the salamander So it's a huge concern for us in the United States where B-sal hasn't emerged and where we have a lot of salamander diversity. So here's a cute little infographic I made of life cycle of BD. So like other fungi, BD starts off as a spore. That's just how it reproduces. But its spore is motile. So the spore has a little flagella like a sperm and it swims through the water column. So it'll swim through and it'll embed on the host. So it'll embed and put down these anchors and then it'll start to grow. And it'll produce more and more spores and those spores will start to mature. And once it gets close to bursting, it'll produce a channel. And this channel allows these mature zoospores to be released back into the water column where they can infect a new host or they can reinfect their current host and increase the disease intensity of that individual and lead to its mortality. So you can have transfer of BD in a number of different ways through contaminated like water or soil material from host to host. So when amphibians come into contact for mating or any sort of other behaviors where they might physically touch or just being in the same area. So you can have these cross species transfer if you have a diverse community. So both BD and B-sal have their origins in Asia and Southeast Asia where they've co-evolved with many amphibian species there, but we've spread them all around the world. Oh, well, namely BD around the world. B-sal is just restricted to Europe and Asia as far as we know. And we trade amphibians for a number of different reasons. We trade them as food. Bullfrogs especially are eaten in many parts of the world. They're native to the United States, but many bullfrogs are farmed commercially in Asia and South America where they're food staples. We trade amphibians for research. So Xenopus frogs are heavily used as model organisms in a lot of research systems. So we spread, we trade those and with them their pathogens. And then we trade animals for the pet trade. I keep amphibians, so I'm very aware and conscientious of making sure that I'm getting amphibians that aren't captured from the wild, that are from reputable sources and that are tested for pathogens. But that's not the case in many, in most wildlife, right? A lot of amphibians trade isn't regulated very well. So not only are people trading amphibians that might be threatened in their range, they're also bringing in these pathogens. So this infographic is showing how some of these different lineages or strains of BD have just been spread around the world and on what hosts. So when you have these different lineages, which are really adapted to the populations they've evolved with, so they have the shared evolutionary history, when you bring them into areas where they might come in contact with amphibians who don't have that shared evolutionary history and possible no defenses, you're really setting up amphibian populations to collapse or some species to go extinct. The shocking thing about BD is it's very nonspecific. It has a huge host range. So we know of over 700 species of amphibians that can play host to BD, and it's likely way, way more. We just haven't gotten around to testing all of them. But the amphibian responses to the pathogen can vary wildly. So this figure is just showing that there are patterns that we see in susceptibility. So these darker reds and yellows are species that have been hit harder with BD, and we see clustering of them, and a lot of them, you know, are taxonomic. So we see this Atelopus genus has been hit really hard, and some genera or some families just really haven't. And we're interested in kind of unlocking that and understanding why. Why have some species gone extinct or declined, and other species remain intact? They might have infections, but they don't succumb to them. So those are questions we're interested in answering. And largely it boils down to interactions between the amphibian itself, the pathogen characteristics, like what lineage do we have, how virulent is that lineage, and then the environment. What sort of environmental constraints are on both host and pathogen, and are they conducive to the proliferation of either? So amphibians do have some defenses to chytrid, and some of those are shared across different groups, phylogenetic groups, and some aren't. Most amphibians produce antimicrobial peptides in their skin microbiome. So on amphibian skin, they have just a number, like thousands and thousands of different bacteria. We have them too. We have important gut flora, we have skin flora that are really important for, you know, really minute to really big functions. And the same with amphibians. So their skin is kind of their frontline defense. And some of these bacteria on their skin can produce peptides that inhibit the growth of pathogens, BD included. So there's work being done trying to seed other amphibians with these probiotics, essentially, to see if they can then fight off BD infection. And then some amphibians are able to produce antimicrobial peptides themselves in specialized glands that they then secrete in their mucus and wipe their mucus all over their body. And sometimes that can inhibit BD growth. But these aren't universal. Not all amphibians produce their own AMPs. And oftentimes their microbiota might not produce antimicrobial peptides that work against BD. And then some folks are also looking at the MHC immune response. So this is adaptive immunity. So think of like an antigen antibody response. So when we become sick with anything, our body mounts an immune response, and then we start developing antibodies to the pathogen, which is an antigen. So we fight off that infection, and our body remembers that through memory cells. And then when we encounter that pathogen again, we can produce those antibodies again to fight an infection. We're not sure how that works in frogs entirely and whether or not that's enough to mount an immune response to BD. BD can suppress the immune response in some cases, or it can cause an overexcitation of that immune response, which can be detrimental to the frog. So we're not really sure how that works. But we do know that some frogs produce antibodies and some frogs don't. So this is an area we're exploring, and it's really interesting. So our lab is really worried about BSL entering the United States, right? Here in the United States, we're a hot spot for salamander biodiversity. So when you think about patterns of intense biodiversity around the world, we tend to think of the tropics. And that's the case for most things. It's certainly the case for frogs and Sicilians, but not salamanders. Salamanders are most diverse in the southeastern United States, and then in high montane regions of Central America. So we're concerned that if B. sal were somehow to enter the United States and get into the southeastern United States, that it could really do irreparable damage to our salamander community here. We have over 150 salamanders native to North America, many of them in the southeastern region here along the Appalachian Trail and on the coastal plain. Many of these are lungless salamanders in the family Plethodontidae. They're a highly diverse group, and nowhere are they more diverse than in the Americas. So we're tackling this on a number of different levels by testing certain amphibians in labs and presenting them with the diseases to see if they die, and we can make predictions or projections about how wild populations might fare. And we can better inform conservation strategies or mitigation or funding to conserve areas or species, and also testing the environment to see how conducive it is to pathogen growth. So the way that we actually test for BD or B. sal is we just swab the animal on the underside. You can swab both living animals or museum specimens, and they both have valuable information. So by swabbing museum specimens that can be over 100 years old, you can first pinpoint roughly when BD was introduced to an area and then the subsequent effects that it's had on populations. If you notice that populations start to decrease or they go extinct after this event, then you can start to, you know, make conclusions or project how populations dealt with or didn't deal with BD. So we'll take those swabs, we'll extract the DNA, and we run it through qPCR. And all that does is it focuses on these areas of BD or B. sal's genome and amplifies them. And when we get these nice curves, it lets us know that BD was found in each of these samples. So you can go and count the curves and find out how many and what samples had BD on them. It's very simple, very straightforward. But to throw a really complex case out there is one of my study organisms, which is the striped newt, which is has a lot of challenges in questions that I'm trying to answer about its disease susceptibility and its conservation. So it's a newt. So newts are a type of salamander. They're in the family Salamandridae, and they have a really interesting life history. So they're triphasic, unlike frogs, which are biphasic. So they have aquatic larvae, and typically the aquatic larvae will undergo metamorphosis into a juvenile terrestrial stage called an eft. So these, a lot of Northeastern people know red efts, and those are the eastern newts, and they'll see them in the forest. They're bright red because they contain toxins. So the close that highly specialized. It's only found in Georgia and Florida in a couple of ponds, so it's not as widespread as its eastern cousin, but it goes through that same sort of phase of having this eft. So when it undergoes metamorphosis, it has these distinct changes in its physiology, right? So it develops lungs, and it absorbs its gills, and it starts to gain keratin in its tissue. Because it's transitioning to a terrestrial life, it needs to resist desiccation. So this is when it's probably susceptible to infections by BD or B. sal, because it now has the resource that the pathogen needs to grow. And then after this eft phase, it'll spend time in on land and mature into an adult newt. And then that adult newt will come to the water to breed and start the cycle over. So that's pretty straightforward. It's just these three interesting phases, but this newt has to throw a curveball, and this aquatic larvae can forego metamorphosis entirely and become what's called a pedomorph. So these are sexually mature larvae. So these are larvae that will reproduce. They have all their larval characteristics, so reduced keratin. They've got these branchy gills, and they will stay in the water as long as it's good, and they will reproduce. Their offspring can also just stay as pedomorphs or go to the terrestrial phase. So there's some weird things acting on it. Even weirder, these pedomorphs can mate with terrestrial adults as well. So you can get this crossing of generations and different life history strategies. And these pedomorphs, after they've mated, typically what happens a year after they remain a pedomorph, their next mating cycle, they'll metamorphose and they'll go into a terrestrial adult and skip the eft phase. So it presents a challenge for me when I'm trying to make a sweeping statement about this species and how it's going to fare given a pathogen introduction, because the pathogen is going to act selectively on different life histories, like in different life stages. So these two stages of pedomorph and larvae, they don't have keratin in their tissues, at least not in early stages, so they're likely less susceptible to these pathogens, whereas the eft and the adult have more keratin and they're more susceptible. So, you know, these pathogens might do damage to two life stages, but they're not going to, might not eradicate the species, and they're not going to stop reproduction if pedomorphs can still breed. And I'm interested in really long-term questions about population dynamics in diseases. Are we selecting for pedomorphic populations in some of these populations because the terrestrial and eft phases are more susceptible to disease? So yeah, it's hard to definitively say whether this species will be affected on a large scale because it has a kind of fail-safe against different challenges. So currently my work right now is trying to answer those questions with this newt. So this is a threatened newt species. It's a candidate for the Endangered Species Act. And we're trying to figure out how these pathogens might affect it, whether BD is in its environment, and how community structure of different amphibians affects the population structure, the disease dynamics of this amphibian in particular, and also how all those little life history strategies play into its diseases. Like, it's amazing, cool, weird little newt. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter, really. I don't do Instagram anymore. You can email me.
Awesome. Okay, that's super cool. Okay, so what's the deal with axolotls? Like, I have one in my house, but so it's stuck, right? In like a similar, what did you call it? A pedomorph?
A pedomorph. So yeah, so axolotls are obligates. So they will always, typically always be these pedomorphic adults. They'll retain those like larval characteristics. So my newts are facultative. So they can switch between what life cycle. So sometimes axolotls will morph out, but it's usually under stress. So when water dries out, when water parameters aren't good, I know that people have exposed them experimentally to iodine and that'll cause them to undergo metamorphosis. But usually after they undergo metamorphosis, they'll die after a year or two. It's so stressful for them compared to other species. Yeah, they're weird. There's a couple different Ambystoma, which axolotl is in that genus of mole salamanders, and most of them in Mexico that are fully aquatic.
Cool. All right, so we've got a question from Ella from Miss Nolan's class. They want to know, is there a chance that the pathogen can transfer to other types of animals, like mammals or reptiles?
So, yes, that's a really good question because it was surprising for people who found out. So there are two different like non-amphibian, they're not really hosts, but the pathogen's able to like live or be transported by them. So the first is crayfish. So they've found that BD can exist in like the lungs of crayfish, or like their gills inside, and that crayfish could possibly act as a reservoir for BD whenever habitats dry down, or transfer it from habitat when they move. And then birds. So they've found that waterfowl that carry water in their feathers, I think this was in Puerto Rico, were able to transfer BD from like water body to water body just because they were moving from habitat and while still wet.
Gotcha. That's troubling. The next question is from Grant, age 10. What are we doing to help the frogs with this infection? Is there a way that we can do more?
Gosh. So there's a number of different things that people are doing. So for species, you have to break it into two groups, right? So there's the groups that haven't been exposed that you want to protect from pathogens getting into those environments. So that's like legislation and funding for conservation. So that's like donating to like local conservation organizations or supporting legislation through like Fish and Wildlife that sets aside habitat or species and protection and disease monitoring. And then there are the populations that have declined or gone extinct in the wild. And that's a different challenge. So in zoos and different agencies, they'll have breeding colonies of some of these amphibians for eventual release back into the wild. But there's a challenge there because the pathogen might still exist in their wild habitat. So you might be putting amphibians back into their habitat where the disease still is. So that's a huge challenge that captive breeding colonies are trying to address. So that's why we look into their microbiome to see if there's something we can augment or change. But yeah,
cool.
Good question.
A couple people wanted to know, like, where did BD come from? Like, is it, like, how did it come to be? Is it our fault? Like, what's the deal?
I think largely its current distribution is our fault. But so it originated, I think, recent literature, Southeast Asia, probably Korea. So we find BD and BSAL affecting Southeastern Asian amphibians, so frogs and salamanders in Southeast Asia. Sometimes at really high incidences, but with low mortality or no observed mortality and like low rates of disease. So oftentimes these amphibians can just clear it, whereas outside of that range, they won't and they'll die. So yeah, I think they've isolated down to probably the Korean peninsula.
Gotcha. Are there any frogs that are poisonous?
Yes, I keep a lot of them. So most frogs and toads, by that definition, are poisonous. So they have specialized glands called granular glands that they produce poison in. Now, toads are really famous for being poisonous because they have those large glands on the back called parotoid glands. And sometimes, you shouldn't do this, but if you squeeze them, you can express them and like there will be a poison that comes out. But then, of course, there are some really famous examples. Like in here, I have a blue poison dart frog. This is from one of my breeding groups here. You see a little belly. So these frogs are poisonous, but they don't manufacture their own poison. It's thought that they get it from their diet. So they'll in the wild, they'll eat little arthropods or beetles, and they're able to manufacture toxins based on what they're eating. But when you keep them in captivity, they lose that ability to produce poison. So I keep around 7 species of dart frog, and none of them are toxic.
This whole time, I thought you were just living on the edge over there, just like having a bunch of dangerous frogs in your house. But that's awesome.
Nothing's dangerous. Like, the worst thing are the crickets. I hate them.
Awesome. The next question is, do we know like what environmental conditions or what have you would make one of the larvae decide to go pedomorph or like eft? Like what?
So we don't know that in, we don't know definitively in the striped newt. We know in other systems, it's usually tied to water parameters. Like if a pond starts drying, and it's been shown in some frogs too, that if a pond starts drying, they'll undergo metamorphosis much quicker, but at the cost of physical fitness. So they might metamorphose as smaller individuals as a kind of like failsafe, like at least we didn't die. So we don't know. Salamander species, if the water is constant or permanent, then sometimes they won't metamorphose. They'll just stay because they have no need to.
Right. Cool.
But I think it's an adaptation to these. They breed in ephemeral ponds, so ponds that fill up during the summer and might dry up in other parts of the year. So it's probably an adaptation to that.
Cool. We've got a really cool question from Emily Durkin. Emily wants to know, when zoospores encounter amphibian hosts, is it like random, they just like bump into one, or do they like sniff them out in some way?
I'm not sure if they sniff them out, but they're shedding these in such high numbers that it's randomly going to be encountered, I think. So they're producing thousands and tens of thousands of zoospores that are just be shedding. So if you imagine like 100 frogs in a pond that are all infected, they're all shedding millions of zoospores to one another. And now the zoospores can only swim a small direction. I think there was work done that did show that they would swim towards frogs, but I'm not really sure exactly why, if there was some weird cue. But yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, cool. Maddie would like to know, how long does the pathogen stay in the water or the soil? Like, is there a known timeline where we say, okay, we've eradicated it, let's just chill, and then let the frogs go back?
Gosh. So I know that after like a couple hours, not even a couple hours, maybe a couple minutes, an hour, the zoospore will stop moving, but it's still pathogenic. I'm not sure how long they exist in the water column. I don't think it's fairly long, but because there's a constant cycle of shedding, that it's just persistent. But the BSAL zoospores, since they can insist, they can resist desiccation, they can be carried in dry soils, so they're not reliant on things being as wet as the BD ones are. So I'm not sure the exact timeline. I just know BSAL is a lot longer.
Oh, Too bad. Okay. Allison is worried that not enough people know that salamanders and frogs are in danger at all. So how do we spread the word?
Gosh, we're trying. it's a huge challenge to kind of communicate that to people. It can be overwhelming, right? We hear the Amazon's on fire. We hear climate change and these crazy weather patterns. And, you know, you don't want to tell people that frogs are going extinct too. So, I know zoos are doing a really good job, especially those that have these captive colonies, and telling stories to visitors that are there, and just even the colonies they have of these frogs. But I think we can all just be, like, we as amphibian researchers need to be a lot more vocal and involved in science communication. I know, like, Jonathan Colby, Frog Rescue, he is amazing and is always out there producing content. But yeah, it's, I don't have the answer to that. I wish I knew how to just engage everybody. But also, a lot of people don't like frogs, which is weird to me. I've met people who are very afraid of them. I don't know. So, just trying to get the word out, social media. And it's hard because they're not as charismatic as big tigers, lions, bears, and all that.
Sounds good. Here's a question that's a little lighter. Do amphibians have ears, and can we see them?
Yes. So some amphibians have ears, and it'll be those little round things. I can actually show you if I share my screen again. Let's see. Who has ears here? do I not have an amphibian with ears? Let's see. Let's go through. So amphibians have these ears called tympanum. So they'll be like these big discs on the side of their head. I think I have right here. So right behind the eye, you'll see that big disc. So that's kind of like an eardrum, right? So some amphibians will have that. And in some species, in the male, it's bigger, and the female, it might be smaller. But some species don't have those ears at all. Doesn't mean they can't hear. They might kind of hear through vibrations and things, but usually animals with tympanum can hear better, I think. But sometimes you can see them, sometimes you can't.
Cool. What eats frogs?
Everything eats frogs. it depends, you know, in what system you are, because sometimes frogs might be like a big predator, and sometimes other frogs will eat smaller frogs. So in the case of like a bullfrog, bullfrogs will eat anything that comes into their mouth. Xenopus frogs will eat anything, including smaller members of their own species. But oftentimes in aquatic habitats, fish and insect larvae are main predators of tadpoles and smaller amphibians. Snakes and birds definitely will eat adults. And then even mammals will go, and I've seen raccoons eating frogs on the side of banks. And there's even a bat species, the frog-eating bat, which is a frog specialist, which uses its echolocation to capture bats, or to capture frogs that are calling for mates.
Wow.
Everyone eats frogs.
Everybody eats frogs, yeah.
I
relate. Everybody eats squid, too. Everybody wants to eat squid. All right, so one of the last questions that we have time for is, let's see, other than chytrid, how is climate change affecting amphibians?
So I think with increasing temperatures, it's going to push amphibians out of designated ranges, right? So especially amphibians that are really specific to certain areas, like let's say mountains, where they need a kind of a perfect thermal climate. So it might push them higher up to maintain like coolness. But also climate change changes weather patterns. So it might change different rain cycles or patterns of weather, which might interfere with breeding, and there might be like a mismatch in there. So it can affect it on a number of layers. That's not just, is it too hot, is it too cold? It might be there's no rain to breed in, and there's no water for us to exist in.
Gotcha. Okay, so now we're gonna ask you the three questions that we ask everybody at the end of all sessions. Are you ready?
Yes.
Great, okay. One, is there anything that you wish we had asked you today that we didn't ask?
No, I was surprised. There were some really great questions and things that I forgot to touch up on. So no, y'all did great. Great question. I was intimidated.
We get great questions here. Okay. And then the final two questions that we ask everybody is, one, what is something that you wish everybody in the world knew about amphibians? And then the second question is, what's something that you wish everybody in the world knew about absolutely anything? It can be as silly and small or big picture significant as you'd like.
Okay. With amphibians, I wish people knew how intricately entwined they are with our environment. So we talk a lot about amphibians being bioindicators of like clean water and quality, and that's true to some extent, but a lot of times they're foundational for ecosystem functions. So like there are some salamander species like redback salamanders, which are the majority biomass in some forests in the Northeast. So even though you might not see them, they play a huge role in moving energy through systems as prey and as predators. So they're just massively important, and they're wonderfully diverse. As far as what people knew just in general, what they should know, I just wish people appreciated the biodiversity around them, local biodiversity. Oftentimes when I go out with people who've lived in an area for years, they might not even know some of the names of the trees around them. And to me, that it's always like one of the first things when I go to a new area. I want to know what I can find around me, what's their name. And I used to think like, you know, if I learned their scientific name, it was kind of like magic, right? So I like that kind of knowledge, and I wish more people felt comfortable doing that. And I wish there were more organizations that just took people, you know, everyday people, and to see the kind of resources that they have around them.
That's awesome. So I recently moved back to Philadelphia, and I had never been to the Jersey Pine Barrens before. And now I'm going all the time, and I am like, so dedicated to learning all the stuff.
So the New Jersey Pine Barrens are part of, you know, a disjunct portion of longleaf pine. So there's stuff in Florida that you can find in the New Jersey Pine Barrens that's so isolated. It's like an island. So there's some cool snakes you should definitely go find in there. I think there's Pine Barrens tree frogs, which are really rare.
I've been looking for those. I know their call. I know what to look for, but we have not found any. We found leopard frogs. We found carpenter frogs, but...
Never seen a carpenter frog. There's something you have on me.
Yeah, okay. Well, next time you're in Philadelphia for whatever reason, we will hop in the Squidmobile and go out to the Pine Barrens. Okay, so that's all we have time for. Is there anything that you would like to plug and remind us where we can find you on social media before we wrap up?
Yeah, just find me on Twitter at amphibiaric. You can DM me a question there. I have a link to our lab website at the Longo Lab. At the University of Florida, you can see the kind of work that we're doing. I don't really have anything to plug except for maybe the Amphibian Foundation. They're a great amphibian conservation group based out of Atlanta, Georgia. So they do captive rearing of endangered species. They also do a lot of local community education. A lot of them teach them about amphibians. They employ a lot of people. They're doing really, really cool work. Both with native species in the United States, like gopher frogs in Georgia, and also species abroad. So they're really, really awesome. So I would plug them, donate to them if you can. I know times are tough, but they're doing great work.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. This was great. And thank you all for being with us and asking questions today. If you can support our program, please, please do. You can do that at patreon.com/skypeascientist or paypal.me/skypeascientist. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so all of your donations are tax deductible for your parents' taxes' sake. We are going to be gearing up for fall soon, so we'll be releasing all of the sign-up forms for fall in August. So stay tuned there. We know that with COVID continuing to be bad, that we're going to have another huge semester at Skype a Scientist. So if you can help support our program, we would really, really appreciate it. We're doing the best we can to bring science to as many people as humanly possible. Thank you, Erin, for signing for us today.
Yeah,
we always appreciate you so much. Okay. So nice to see you again, Arik, and we'll see you later.
Yeah, nice to see you again. Thank you for your questions, everyone. They're great.